You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We're talking for the second time on this show about campaign finance reform, which, as you might guess if you've been listening, is a subject very close to my heart. The gist of why campaign finance reform is so important is, as you probably already know, money determines in many ways who can run for office. And state races cost more than local races. Nationwide races cost more than state races. It's a very expensive proposition. And the reality is money limits who can run for office. And then once the election is over, money influences what the winner does. In other words, if Corporation X gives a huge amount of money to a certain congressperson, that person will tend to keep that corporation in mind when writing or voting on legislation. There's a word to describe that whole pattern, and that word is corruption. In today's podcast, we're going to be talking to John Pudner about the high cost of corruption and what can be done about it. John Pudner is founder and director of a nonprofit called Take Back Our Republic, and they're doing some pretty cool stuff, like showing candidates how to win with a whole lot less money, for one thing. He's an expert in that. And talking to him, I have to say, I learned a lot about what progressives and conservatives have in common. You'll have to listen to find out more about that, but I will give you a hint. He's shut down a bunch of potential Walmarts because they were going to hurt local businesses. Welcome, John Pudner.
Thank you.
So how did you get interested in this whole question of reforming campaign finance, money in politics? What are the problems that you were observing?
I ran campaigns for about 20 years, and the dependency on money and attention to money became a bigger and bigger issue, to a point at which we weren't even looking for candidates anymore that were excellent at articulating positions and solving problems and things we were looking for 20 years ago. It was all, can this candidate self-fund? Or are they willing to be a telemarketer and spend all their time raising money? And that was just unhealthy. And I thought I had to come outside the system to fix it.
And it's an amazing thing that happens in Washington. And as you say, it's a fairly recent phenomenon, the last 20 years, where candidates, when they win, they go into office and they spend so much of their time not governing, but fundraising.
Well, you think, you send a member of Congress from here to represent you, and their normal daily routine is an intern walks over from whichever party's office and tells them they need to go over and have their call time, which means sitting there for hours calling donors, usually not in the state, so these aren't even constituents, and that's what your typical member's day is. You elect them to go be a fundraiser.
So many Democrats, liberals, citizens in our country are against the current system because it seems to give wealthy interests an advantage over, say, the poor, the environment, things like that. You're working from a conservative perspective. What kinds of attitudes toward campaign finance are you seeing from grassroots conservative citizens, from working class people like in Alabama, where you're from?
It's been good. I think you pointed out the problem very well, though. Initially, I think a lot of conservatives just knew it was a bad system, but said, we think this works in our advantage, so we're going to be for this system. I think a good wake-up call was that liberals can figure out how to raise money, too. I mean, President Obama certainly showed he could. Hillary Clinton showed she did all the way down. And I think that was good to have a billion-dollar Democratic presidential campaign to go back to conservatives with and say, hey, both sides can play this game. You know the system's bad. You know we need to fix it. And I think that was a wake-up call. But also, remember, most races are won at the primary level now. It's not a Republican versus Democrat. It's within your party because of redistricting and other factors. So many grassroots conservatives had seen their candidates get destroyed by money in a primary because they weren't the big money candidate. And that's what happened, was a neat underlying theme that people didn't see in public, but was conservatives within primaries getting upset and wanting changes.
And that's something that you've actually worked on. I mean, you've done some seriously David and Goliath kinds of campaigns where you had the person who was the underdog had less money, but you still found ways for them to win.
I did. I used to in my campaign days, and I gave up all campaigning 2 years ago to do this. So I do just want to be very state that right up front. I don't run campaigns anymore. I used to tell people, you can find someone with a better winning percentage than me. You will not find anyone who won more races when being outspent more than 3-1. There's a grassroots way to win campaigns. It can be door to door in a more urban suburban area. It can be working events in a rural area, but also, you have to be data-driven. And so many grassroots candidates that much money don't get that. They either hate the data or the other way around. You have kind of young techies who hate the old door-to-door. And if you just do those both, you can overcome money. So we had a bunch of races like that. We won just legislative races. And these were all for Republicans. And then Dave Bratt, recruited him, and he defeated Eric Cantor. And that was the one race where we'd only raised $18,000 through a few months to overcome $5 million, and did. So that was kind of the final one. And I felt like at that point, I don't think we can repeat that much unless we change the system. So I kind of went out on that race.
So even though you have shown that you can win races with far less money, you still think it's an important thing to get more money out of politics.
It is. You know, look at what an exception that race was even in 2014. I mean, as soon as we won, everyone said, oh, all these Tea Party candidates are going to win Republican primaries now. None of them won. I mean, every incumbent won. No incumbent lost. We are actually putting together a people-powered playbook which shows people from any ideological perception how to win a race. We're trying to encapsulize that race. We're talking about how you can use data targeting very inexpensively. All the things consultants want to charge you a ton to do so they can make money, we're going to put it out there, and it's going to be an open source so anyone can use it. As a nonprofit, we can do that. Now, I can't write a book and go back and say, hey, Republican Party, I'm writing you a book on how to win. That's, you know, we cannot do partisan politics. We cannot try to elect someone there. But what we are allowed to do is an open source that anyone can access. And what we really want is candidates not to be dependent on the big money, to stop spending 85% of their time raising money and start doing things that make them better representatives.
When you talk to business owners, and we're not talking now about Exxon and Monsanto, but talking about small, medium-sized business owners, maybe family business owners or larger than that, but still, you know, a state level, regional level, what are they saying?
Yeah, sometimes there's some hesitancy at first. They think of campaign finance reform as a progressive issue. So there's usually a little initial language obstacle. But as soon as I talk picking winners and losers, they get it immediately. I mean, the idea that procurements are done based on campaign contributions, that someone from out of state is getting a deal with taxpayer money because they were making political contributions and they aren't giving the state the best deal. That's where you really get them. One thing I used to say even back in my campaign days, I tell people, look, the Chamber of Commerce and Walmart are not your friend. They're the friend of whoever just won the last election. You know, you're even within the Republican circles, NFIB, your small business owner, I mean, they were the ones who were really the, you know, the bloodline to a lot of these races. And for that matter, for years, even though I was doing conservative politics, I was fighting Walmarts too. I killed a dozen Walmarts just by rallying communities against them and saying, look, once they come in, they kill off all your local businesses. And I think that was a perfect prelude, if you will, to campaign finance reform. It was money affecting political decisions that ultimately would hurt the community.
It really also blurs the line between liberal and conservative. I mean, I sometimes think that those words are becoming outdated because the concerns of real people on the ground, working class people, working people who are not million and billionaires, have a lot more in common than they have different.
Absolutely. I think the battles between transactional givers and ideological givers, even among your contributors, before you even get to voters. Yeah, there are people who, rich people, who give plenty of money because they want a more progressive government or a more conservative government. I really don't have that much problem there. If that's all we were talking about, maybe I wouldn't think this was top priority. The problem is so much of it is transactional now. There's a spreadsheet where people are saying, the best return I can get in business right now is political contributions that lead to me getting a bunch of taxpayer money or tax breaks, or depending on what your business is. And that's the problem. It's giving away our tax money to the highest bidder and having them make $20 off the one they put into political campaigns.
Now, in New Mexico, we call that pay to play.
Yes.
And it could be anything from people who make asphalt and then get the contract to build the roads. It could be private prison. It could be a business like a Walmart that wants to move into a community. all of those things they consider a political contribution. They consider it an investment, essentially, a business investment.
You've got it right on. We ran a referendum to change campaign finance laws in South Dakota. And the Koch brothers were our main opponent in that. They wanted to keep a system there where you didn't even have to report any gifts or campaign contributions. I remember I said gifts included. You can buy a legislator a car and not tell anyone and have legislation in front of them or be bidding. And they tried to say that some of the aspects we had, like a $60 voucher to let everyone contribute to a political campaign, were taking money from individuals and giving them to politicians. What I had to point out is the Koch brothers had 10 asphalt plants, to use your case study, surrounding the state of South Dakota. None of them actually in South Dakota, so these weren't even South Dakota businesses, but 10 of the 14 asphalt plants they had in the country surrounded that state. Well, they're in bidding on $300 million in road deals. Now, you don't think more money's lost by a political donor being paid a premium as opposed to someone in South Dakota doing the work? And so that's the kind of thing we have to hit. You're absolutely right. This is such a money saver if we fix this system.
It's not only a money saver, which it is, it's not only an avoider of corruption, which it is, but it's also an opportunity for the best bidder to actually be chosen to do the job. And given the great variety of competence from highly competent to totally incompetent, that really makes a difference.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'd basically say a tie should go to the in-state bidder. I mean, I'm not saying the in-state bidder should get everything, but, you know, an in-state entity that's already paying taxes should certainly have some preference in a close call on a bid, I would say. And let me tell you something. If there aren't limits on campaign contributions one day in New Mexico, let's just say they were done away with, do you think any New Mexican businesses are outbidding any of the big out-of-state ones coming in? So, no, you're absolutely right. And often the in-state person does know the state better. I mean, there may be aspects of the terrain, the beautiful terrain I'm looking at here, the geography, that an in-state person just knows and gets. We lost one case to Walmart in Pennsylvania where our locals were insisting they could not build on this one ridge. They insisted they could. The ridge collapsed, shut down a state road for almost a year. They're still fixing it. I think this is 10 years later. As an example, they brought in out-of-state people. And that's not quite a campaign finance issue, but you can see how it's similar. They just overrode the locals with money, and you don't want that.
Tell us a little bit about what happened in South Dakota, because that was a really interesting example in very much of a red state.
It was. I think one reason we really wanted to get involved there was a red state. And basically, the people defending the current law, which I just consider a very corrupt law, were trying to stop change. And their argument was, a bunch of out-of-state liberals want to change our law. This is how we do things in South Dakota. So I went into the state and made one very straight-on analogy at the beginning. I said, look, anyone in this state voting for Donald Trump should be voting for this law. Trump says he wants to clean up the system. He says everything's rigged. This is the most rigged state there is. And ended up with a headline literally an hour after setting foot in South Dakota that said, Trump supporters should back IM-22, which sent the Republican Party there crazy. I mean, they came out against it. Koch brothers dropped $600,000 against us at the end. But we just made the case. You know, take away everything else you care about the presidential election. This and Bernie Sanders and others are being driven by there's a corrupt system that has to be fixed. And so for us, it was very significant to go into a red state and say, look, I don't care how red your state is. This is no longer just a progressive issue. We may have slightly different solutions, but the issue itself is affecting everyone.
But what was the solution they actually came up with?
We had a pretty hard-hitting solution. I think if they'd bargained with us a little, they might have gotten a better deal. We ended up with $500 campaign limits. I would not have been that as aggressive, but going from unlimited to we're not budging to, okay, how about $500? You know, that's a tough one for them. Full disclosure, if you give, it's going to be reported. And if Koch brothers want to give a bunch of money and then bid for a road contract and they win it because they're the best bidder, that's fine. But let's at least have the voter know, hey, my representative who just voted to give them this big procurement also received a bunch of money from them. And I'm just using them as an example. It could be someone on the left, Tom Steyer, whoever. But full disclosure, and everyone gets a $60 voucher, which they can use if they want on a campaign. I will say that from a conservative perspective, we prefer tax credits when we can have them, giving everyone the ability to give up to $200 and get it back on their taxes. South Dakota does not have an income tax, so we were happy to go along with the voucher in that case. But the important thing is giving local people who've given up on the system some ability to contribute, because once they contribute, they pay attention.
So that is what happened in South Dakota, although it didn't last very long. The measure was repealed by the Republicans in the state legislature. But this idea of the voucher is very interesting because it's basically, it's taxpayer money that the taxpayer can choose to use or not choose and then give to a political candidate of their choice?
That's right. Now, that's our second choice. And a lot of more progressive groups would prefer that. Our preference is what they do in Virginia and Ohio and Oregon, where you have a tax credit. So you actually have to fill out your tax form and say, I gave up to, it's just $50 in those states, but I gave $50 or I gave five candidates $10, and then I claim it back in my taxes and get it back. So we'd prefer that because for us, from a conservative perspective, that is the money I was going to give the IRS if you did this at the federal level. I'm instead choosing a candidate I agree with. The voucher system's a little more aggressive because everyone gets it. So obviously some progressive groups prefer that. But yes, you are mailing it to everyone. So the issue there is public financing's trickier, not as popular. I have some issues with it as a first choice, just that you are printing extra money, if you will. But it does, if you can get rid of corruption, in the end, you can save so much money on it. In South Dakota, there was a study that showed that if the state only had the average level of corruption, the average citizen would save $1,300 a year. And I believe that's probably figures very close here because I know New Mexico is rated as one of the most corrupt states. So you're probably in that ballpark. You can save $1,000 each just doing these kind of things to fix the system.
And of course, the advantage of the voucher system is that there are a lot of people in New Mexico and in South Dakota who can't afford $60.
That's right. That's right. And I think when you have, 800,000 here out of 2.1 million qualify for Medicaid, I think. I mean, some of the stats, certainly, I realize looking at those numbers. So those are valid arguments for them. We still prefer a tax credit, but I readily admit there's some very good arguments on the other side.
So what are some other ways that you deal with what's called transactional giving, pay to play, that kind of thing?
Well, I think we just have to try to get rid of dark money. I prefer to call it secret money because everyone gets what that is. Some of the loopholes that are being used now to get money in that's never disclosed are a huge problem. Setting up LLCs in certain states that have the sole purpose of moving political money in without disclosure. This isn't an LLC that you set up to do business or run your show or whatever. This is, I set up an LLC because I want to sneak money into New Mexico and I don't want anyone to know I'm giving because I have a vested interest. So disclosure is so key for us. We have to have disclosure. We've got to at least know. At least once you know who's giving, you can make decisions on it. That cleans up a lot of it.
Now, when you have disclosure, let's say a contractor gives a large contribution to a campaign, then the contractor gets the contract, and there's full disclosure, and we know it, but it's still pay to play.
It is. It doesn't solve the problem. But I guess what I'm saying is, for example, government contractors funnel their money through the Chamber of Commerce, and then they bid on government contracts. So you now have $147 billion going to a couple of dozen different companies. Now, I'm sure some of that's legitimate. They're the only one that can build something. But they're hiding all their political contributions. We ironically took people from several states to the White House to ask President Obama, I mean, just a protest out front, we didn't talk to him, ask him to sign executive order saying that if you are getting government contracts, you have to disclose all your political giving. You can't hide it through these third parties. And he never signed it. That was a little frustration for us because, he seemed very active with executive orders. So we're hoping that can be accomplished, and that should be done in every state. I think anyone who's giving money and then getting it back, at least let us know it. That's the first step. You're right, it doesn't clean up all pay for play, but at least if there's the possibility for someone with a good political mind to make that a campaign issue, you at least have a chance to start to fight that and make it stop.
Now, does that have to be done state by state, or is there a federal solution? I mean, you just said this executive order that wasn't signed.
Yes. Well, that would deal with just federal contracts. So, I mean, that would only address the federal side. And I don't know the New Mexico code well enough to know the law here, but every state has different laws. Some do have full disclosure, so you do know this.
Oh, so of course. Okay, got it. So that for federal races, you've got federal laws. For state races, you have state laws.
That's right.
So another idea that you are working with is raising the individual level for anonymous, in other words, undisclosed, unreported contributions. Now, that's sort of the opposite of what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, let me clarify that. That's actually not what we're trying to do. What we have said is if there were a package deal that would disclose all money so we knew where it was coming from, we'd be open to, as part of a deal, up the limit on what you give directly to a member of Congress. See, the problem right now is some of these races, like the Republican primaries early on, 85% of the spending was through third parties. Only 15% was the candidates. So what we've said is we're not out there trying to up limits at all, but what we're saying is right now, if a member goes to someone, they say, I want to give you $100,000 for a congressional race, what do you say? You say, well, you can give $2,700 to me. That's the limit. But my friend Jim down the hall runs a super PAC with different rules. Talk to him. So you go give $100,000 to him, and it's all used for you. That's the worst possible system. So we're
and
not,
that's the system we have.
That's the system we have. So all we're saying is, one, I'd say more in a baby step, is if they would make all those super PACs and LLCs and everyone play under the same rules as the direct giving, I'd be okay with, in a trade-off, upping that $2,700 for the direct giving. Because the reason campaigns are so negative now is no one's name is on the commercials. And when I sit down with a candidate and we wanted to go after an opponent, it can be perfectly legitimate, but when my candidate's name and picture had to be on that commercial, you better believe we had our facts straight. Now, no one cares. Now, if I walked in here tomorrow and formed People Who Love New Mexico, even though I don't live here, and started running commercials, I wouldn't care if people hated my group. Yeah, you know, I could make things up. I mean, if I'm unethical here, I'd start accusing people of things. There's no accountability. If your opponent has to do it, that's a much better system, and that's where we used to be.
Like, I'm so-and-so, and I approve this message.
Yes, make them do that every time.
But there was also something that I thought I read in your literature about people who wanted to give up to a much smaller amount, like in the few hundreds of dollars, who didn't want to have their names on it because they were afraid of retaliation. I don't know how common retaliation is or what it looks like.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I see. Yes, that is a valid point. What we have talked about is I think you could go higher than the $200 before you have to disclose. I don't think anyone's buying an elected official for $500. You know? And there are some people who really don't have that much money, but they can occasionally give a couple, few hundred dollars. We want to encourage that. We want to encourage more small donors. We're open to them not having to report until, say, they go to $501. The retribution, there are some cases where people do get targeted. They're on a campaign finance list, and here they've given their first check of $250, and they get on a list, or they have a little business, and people are saying, no one shop there, no one do this. You know, that's a bit of a side issue. It's not one of our central issues, but we're open to the disclosure level being a little higher than $200, but we want full disclosure, certainly beyond 1,000, maybe beyond 500. You know, we certainly want full disclosure there.
Because that's, I mean, at a lower level, if I give $200 or $500 to somebody's campaign, it means I support your ideas. If I give $10,000, it means I support your ideas and I want something back.
Absolutely. I saw Ben Carson. I ran into him at something 2 months after we started his group, and I started a sentence to him. I said, Dr. Carson, we've got to find ways to encourage higher participation and more small donors. And he finished my sentence. He said, because unlike the big donors, they don't expect anything in return. And so we're on the same wavelength on that moment, at least.
It's interesting because there's always a bit of a trade-off between privacy on the one hand and transparency on the other.
That's right. And that's why we do talk about retribution. You know, we've talked about, in addition to wanting full disclosure, can we craft a anti-retribution bill that maybe says you can't get fired for a political contribution? I mean, we're exploring some things like that that lawyers think could be passed, because what we don't want is, you know, some boss is for one candidate, six of the employees are for another one, and suddenly they say, hey, look, I saw you gave a check. Yeah, this is bad. This is bad for our business. Yeah, they start pressuring them, and that's what we don't want.
And you've seen that.
Yes, I certainly think that happens. I think there's a chilling effect, and then that person stops becoming a donor. donor. It's like, well, gosh, I don't want any trouble. I mean, I was just trying to give to someone I liked.
Right. One of the things you talked about before was having a tax credit for donations, or as in South Dakota, as we talked about, vouchers for donations. Okay. Are we talking about up to, like, those smaller donors?
Oh, yes. Just $200 total for a
okay.
person. I mean, you could give 20 candidates $10 each if you wanted, but $200 is all you get a tax credit on.
Okay, because otherwise
yes.
you'd have tax-deductible corruption.
Yes, that's correct. This is one thing that really bugged me. I first floated this idea, and they said, oh, well, that might take Congress 10, 20 years to do. And a few weeks after that, there was an article run by the New York Times where Congress stayed in session until 2 a.m. to pass something to make it absolutely clear that the billionaires who gave to super PACs and other things would not have to pay a tax on that money. It cannot be considered gift in a gift tax. I'm like, well, that took one day to protect billionaires, and you're telling me it's going to take 10 years to protect the $200 donor?
Right.
So, yeah, I think this would be a really encouraging move.
What is your perception of how people who are in office, I mean, like, how is it in their interest to vote to protect billionaires? I mean, yeah, we've got the system we've got, but presumably at least some of those people, and I would imagine or hope the majority of them, actually would kind of like to govern and not just fundraise all day.
I think we're getting there. I think the initial human nature that you always see is if someone's been successful in a certain system, they tend to like that system to stay in place, whether it's politics or something else. But I think you're right, and that's another reason the trade-off I alluded to, and if you could up that 2,700, we started getting some progress on that among some officials who thought they were against any reform, started going, oh, wait, you mean I'd actually have something to do with my own campaign again? Because right now they're being sold like a can of Coke and Pepsi. You know,
yeah.
It's a third party selling, and they're getting you through or not. You're completely dependent on them. So, yeah, we'd like to have them be part of the campaign. We'd like the giving to go that way. And at that point, they started to realize, oh, maybe this current system isn't as good as I thought. And, oh, by the way, the guy who rolled in here and mentioned he had a $10 million super PAC and, you know, would really like you to vote for something, you stop having to be threatened by that guy and go, oh, gosh, I'm going to have $3 million making sure my whole family knows I'm a scumbag and I've got to raise $2,700 a time to try to combat it. So we hope to get there. You're absolutely right. I just think it's that initial hurdle of I've won in this system. Why would I want it to change?
Right, right. But, I mean, it's like I was just thinking the other day, I mean, you know, high schoolers, they all have, like, they have their debate teams.
Right.
And it would be so interesting to have, like, the whole country debating the question, is the United States a democracy?
Right.
In some ways it is. In some ways it isn't.
Right.
And in the ways that you're talking about, when a candidate or an official, a congressman, congresswoman, is more beholden to the biggest donor to a super PAC than to his or her thousands of or millions of constituents,
absolutely.
Not a democracy.
Absolutely. And you can even sub the word republic for some, you know, a actual representative republic where the constituents are the person they're taking direction from.
Yeah.
So whether you talk pure democracy republic, but you're absolutely right. And remember, these donors aren't usually here. That's why I keep trying to stress to people. I mean, unless you're representing Manhattan or something, you're not calling constituents for the big money. So your constituency becomes people in Manhattan or somewhere else who fund your whole campaign. And so they have a lot of members of Congress now as representatives. You're absolutely right. I'll tell you a quick one. There was actually a Democrat kind of day for new candidates, but it's the same as Republican. This would happen to be Democrat. A Democrat member of Congress told me about him from out west. And they found out last minute the media was going to be allowed in. And so the media went in, and part of the notebook that each new candidate had was you need to spend 50% of your time raising money. Well, the media went crazy over this. Isn't this terrible? You know, why would these people have to spend 50% raising money instead of doing other things like talking to their constituents, solving problems? Well, this member told me the funny thing was when they found out the media was coming, they took out the page because it had said 85% of your time should be spent raising money, and the media never even saw that. But that's it in both parties. When I started running it, you spend about a third of your time raising money, a third of it solving problems, a third of it talking to constituents, whether it was going to events or talking on the phone, or it was a third, and a third. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I understand raising money can be a piece of it. I don't have a problem with that. But to go from that to 85% raising money, there's no time left to solve problems or to know what anyone back home is thinking.
It also really changes who you are because I mean, who you are, so much of that is your loyalties and your culture, the people you're actually spending time with on a given day.
Absolutely. You know, we had Virginia, Alabama, New York had something interesting. They're three very different states. All interesting because they basically all had the top official from each party get convicted at a similar time. So this isn't a partisan thing. New York had both the Democrat speaker and House Senate leader convicted on money issues. Virginia had convicted in every case. The last Republican governor got convicted. Now, U.S. Supreme Court ended up throwing out the sentence, but it went that far. And then it was announced that the current Democratic governor was under FBI investigation on money issues. Alabama, speaker convicted to years in jail. And the last Democratic governor still in jail. So these things are happening no matter how different the states are. And the thing is, I knew a couple of those people when they went in. I knew the Republican governor, and I knew the Republican speaker in Alabama. They were both good. I'm going to come in. I'm going to fix things. I'm going to get things done. And the pressure to raise money every day of your life, you could just see the change over time. And I'm not passing judgment on whether or not the convictions are right or not right. The point is, they were locked into nothing but asking for money, and it just kills your character long term.
Yeah. It would be so interesting, and I'm sure you've thought about this more than most people, to imagine and sort of project forward. Let's say that your group and the other groups that were responsible for really trying to get money out of politics, you know, a real bipartisan, multipartisan coalition of people who have the same interest in getting money out of politics and actually restoring a democracy or a democratic republic, as you say. It would be so interesting to see what people started really fighting over then.
Yes, good point. Well, we see it every time a new party takes over a legislature. Suddenly they start killing each other within the party because they have power now. So you're right.
But what are the real issues?
Yeah, no, that's right. What could you get to? I mean, if you aren't just trading off, you know, a road contract to a political donor, how do you best fix the roads here? You know, what do the bridges, are they suddenly in repair? Are they, you know, even addressing the non-ideological issues that you could do if you don't have that taint of money dominating everything? You're right. There'd be a lot of things would be fixed.
Very interesting. Now, another thing that you are looking at is the influence of foreign money in elections, which is, let's just say right now, it's completely illegal.
Right.
It happens anyway. It happens in lots of different ways. What does it actually look like? What are your ideas for dealing with it?
Well, it's twofold. One, this is one problem with allowing secret money. If someone's hiding money through an LLC, you don't know where that person's from or where that entity's from. So that can be overseas just as easily as anywhere else. Clearly, there are people overseas who care about the results of our elections. I don't think I have to convince anyone of that in light of the recent conversations, whether it be Russian hacking or anything else. The second one that people overlook is this practice of allowing unverified credit card contributions. Now, this sounds like a small issue at first because we're talking 200 and under donations. But in 2008, a practice started in which candidates started telling their bank, don't verify credit card information coming in. Normally a bank will match your credit card information against what they have on file. It's just an instant check. They don't even retain it. But what they want to say is, hey, wait, this check, this address does not match. So if you try to order something online, we've all done it, type a zip code number wrong, you get a red box, oh shoot, that was a 1, not a 2, and you're done. Now, obviously, if someone stolen your credit card, the point is they may not know some of this information. They may not actually know your address. So this is just a safeguard the banks put in. So in 2008, candidates started realizing you don't have to do that. You can go to the bank and opt out. You have to opt out. The banks don't like to not check this. They want to. So candidates started going to them and saying, go unverified. We've now got about 100 members of Congress who are using unverified systems. The problem with that is anyone who wants can load up a gift card. They can run new names through one after another, $200 at a time, because there's no disclosure requirement and it's not verified, and it's the old modern bags of money. And at first, when I started talking about this a year and a half ago, people were saying, oh, you're crazy, you're a conspiracy theorist, who's doing this? Again, we have foreign entities hacking into our election systems. You don't think they're sitting there and they've got $50 million to play with, they aren't going to just scoot them in? Never detected. No one would detect it in a big campaign. No one would even know it was happening. So they go to a PAC that's hitting someone they don't like. It's so easy to do. So we have a simple bill. It's just a two-page bill saying, you have to allow banks to do their normal verification. You just have to let them check. Now, I wanted to say it's 100 candidates first because this is a little politically loaded because President Obama's campaign was the first one to do it. So I went and met with the person who set it up with them, and I said, look, I don't want this to be a partisan attack. It's just y'all did that, I know, for different reasons, but now everyone's figured out you can do it, and obviously people are taking advantage now. And she explained it to me, Lady Carol Davidson out of New York, who set it up. She said, yeah, the reason we set up is we were going out to fairs, you know, signing, had credit cards on a piece of paper, something was getting smudged, and we were losing some contributions. And I said, so I just want to be clear, this was done for perfectly legitimate purposes. The problem is once a system like that is set up and everyone starts catching on to it, not just the candidates, but people who want to manipulate the system, we just have a wide open door right now. And she was fine. The one who set it up said, I get it completely what you're doing. I can see, I'm sure this is being abused after 7 years.
Do you have any evidence that it's being abused in the way that you're saying? Or, I mean, maybe the whole point is that it's impossible to find that evidence?
That really is the point. And I'd almost say the same thing on, have you found the Russian hacker yet who got into DNC and gave up? You never can. I mean, this is the problem. Once you set up this electronic system that you can do from anywhere, as long as you can hide the IP address you're working from, we'll never catch them. So I'm just past the two-page law. And for anyone who says none of this is happening, I say, great. Then this two-page law, there's no harm to it at all. You can stop any conspiracy thought. And I'm not saying conspiracy. I just think it's people overseas who want elections to go a certain way are going to use it.
I mean, whatever law you pass, there's always going to be another person trying to find a loophole. You know, there's been so many loopholes so big, like in Citizens United, that you could drive a set of trucks through them.
You can. But this one, this was even in the first year, $500 million came through an unverified credit card contributions to, just think of that figure, came through this way. I'm sure it's more than that now. So you close that door. My analogy is you're closing doors to your house. Hey, this back door, the burglar keeps coming to the back door. Let's lock it. Yeah, may try to climb in the window next. Okay, let's look at LLCs where foreign money can be put through. Yeah, there definitely are other doors to be closed. I don't want to pretend this solves all foreign money, but we're just inviting it in right now.
So that credit card verification would verify that that person has a zip code in the United States, basically?
Yes, there is a little extra step that we've taken for someone who's a foreign national, and I don't want to have too much time here. In general, it just verifies, yes, this is an American address. If that happens, nothing else has to happen. This is, the bank has this, it's a real person who lives in the U.S., et cetera. Bingo, that's done. I mean, that wouldn't even stop if someone wasn't really a citizen or didn't even have a green card. They could still pass that step, you know, if they were at least local, had a local address. But it cuts off someone sitting overseas and just faking addresses all the way through.
Right.
It gets a little complicated with an expat working overseas, but Staples, some of the people who set up Staples system have said there is a way to do that. They just would have to add a little extra information.
I wanted to ask you how the reforms we're talking about would be implemented on a national level. I mean, we're talking both, right? We're talking national level, state level.
Absolutely both. And local, even beyond state, sometimes local referendum. I mean, one passed in Seattle that we were not involved with. But seeing a bunch of local referendums suddenly starts to give people in the state a gauge for, wow, people wanted some reform here. So even if you can pass something for a city or at a local level, and the nice thing is that can sometimes be voter-initiated to work around the politicians who want to protect their system. So a lot of this can bubble up from the bottom. And even on the congressional bill we had in, we called people in the states first so that by the time we got to congressional office, they had heard from people back at home. Hey, I just joined this group, Take Back Our Republic. And we in particular targeted conservatives. We wanted conservatives calling conservative members saying, hey, I joined this group. We want campaign finance reform, because it's one thing for someone who's protested five times on five different things you did to say, now I want campaign finance. It's something to say, oh, well, Jim, you've been with me on all my races and you want this thing? You know, I think it started to get some attention. That's why we got 51 Republican co-sponsors. 50 of them were sponsoring their first piece of campaign finance reform ever. and we've had 30-some Democrats, and we're starting to get a bunch of them, too. So it's a very good bipartisan bill, I think.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's this question, you know, to go back to the question of foreign money in elections, I mean, that's illegal. But then there's other sort of analogous questions like out-of-state money in state elections,
yes,
out-of-city money in municipal elections. Are you looking at that? Are there ways to deal with that?
We've looked at it. It's definitely harder to deal with. Let me at least say that. we are, at least with foreign money, talking about something that is illegal. We're just trying to figure out how to enforce it and get laws that help us. One possible solution is that you at least help empower people if they're giving to a race they can vote in. Had an interesting experience. I was speaking to the Georgia Tea Party. I mean, you don't get much further right than this group. And I used the example of the tax credit, and they all really liked it. And then one member raised their hand and said, yeah, but even if everyone in this room gave money, I mean, we're going to be overwhelmed by chamber money in a primary or something. And I said, you are. I said, now, what some people proposed is, if you're giving to a race in which you can vote, your money is also matched. So you're not only incented to give a little check, but it's maybe your $200 turns into $1,000 or something. Most of that room nodded their head and said, yes, this is a Tea Party group. I'd say 80% of the room thought, that would be great. Yeah. So I think there's some openness to discussion on empowering, maybe amplifying is the right word, that local check. I don't think there's any way to stop any outside money from coming in. And that's the one warning I thought to officials here. If you start talking about taking limits off of contributions, that money's not coming from people in New Mexico. What you have then is you're going to have a bidding war for any business in New Mexico, and it's going to be out-of-state mega donors. So at least don't do that where it's not completely no limit, no limits on money. Boy, then you're inviting that money in from out-of-state.
So when you were talking a moment ago about the Georgia Tea Party, and you said, okay, you give $200, but that money could be matched. Explain what you mean by that.
Sure. This is just at the concept stage, but some places, I mean, New York City and others, have said if you enter an agreement that you want matching funds, then every time someone who could vote for you gives you a check, that check is matched. Now, there's a trade-off. If you take that deal, I think there it's huge. It's 6 or 7 times match. So I can vote for you. I give you $100. Hey, you get another $700.
And that's taxpayer money.
That is taxpayer money. So that's the tricky part, because me and most conservatives, initially, when you just talk public financing, we get a little queasy, But at least that gives some self-direction to it. It is a local voter giving a check as opposed to kind of a big pool of money that's being printed, if you will, as extra money. The idea of a match being tied to a resident voting is at least, I think, a palatable discussion even for conservatives that we should explore.
Well, it's basically a way to have a greater local voice and compete with those very out-of-state dollars that you say it's hard to keep out, or out-of-city dollars it's hard to keep out of elections.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier getting money out of politics. And I'd say we don't even go that far. For us, we want to balance money in politics. We think this whole system was setting up a balancing. I don't know. I guess theoretically, if just as much money was given, but suddenly 40% of it were coming from local citizens, I wouldn't have a big issue with that. I'm not so much get rid of all money. There's going to be money there. We just have a seesaw that's so imbalanced now, as you said. It's 57 billionaires. It's some huge corporations, huge unions too. And they are so much of the picture now that your individual donor feels irrelevant. They don't give anymore. And so we just need to move strongly to balance that out.
I have to say, you sound like a progressive.
I always get nervous when that comes up.
No, I mean, well, and you talk about, like, in your work, you talk about conservative solutions. I mean, how are these solutions conservative?
Well, I think, for example, our strong preference for a tax credit is definitely a conservative approach. A lot of the more progressive groups, want public financing, let's say. We're very uneasy with public financing. As I said, I think there's some discussion points when you talk match and all, but that would be a case where, I mean, I've had progressive groups come to me and say, hey, if you would just make that tax credit refundable, we'd be all over it. If everyone could do it, and I'm uneasy with that. For me, there's you're printing money if you do that, and that's a much tougher discussion. So I'd say that's one way. But anything that's market-based that talks about balance, I want to get to the point where progressives and conservatives all agree this is a top priority issue. I think we're really there among the public, just not among officials. Then if we're arguing over whether we're doing a tax credit or a voucher, I think we've won the main argument. And at that point, like you said, when you win one battle, what do you do? Then what do you fight over? Yeah, then maybe I'm having a big fight over, no, I just want this a tax credit. And progressives saying, no, we want this everyone to get a voucher. At least then we've all agreed on empowering the voter, and it's just how do we get there?
And basically, then you have a situation where constituents have a voice. You also have a situation where a lot more people, and you were referring to this in the beginning, can actually consider running for office.
Absolutely. Maine passed a bill, and you now have waiters and waitresses signing up to run for office. There's funding there. It's all about alternate funding. We are also writing a people-powered playbook, which will be open source, and anyone will be able to access it. It basically shows, how is the brat race won? I mean, it's not a history, but here's how you do targeting with online commercials that really work, where you're paying 2 cents per time someone views it versus broadcast media. How do you beat the big money? How do you break that addiction to big money as a candidate? So the next few months, we're going to have it out there. Now, we're a nonprofit, so we can't, by law, take this to some, state Republican party and say, hey, here's our great plan. It all has to be public. So we will release that. We're going to send it all the state parties we can find, Democrat, Republican, any green, whatever, and just try to get that everywhere. But everyone will have a playbook then they can go to. Now, your opponent can go to it too. But if you're a small dollar grassroots candidate, your opponent probably has some consultant who's making them sit in a room and raise money. So they aren't going to use the book because it requires some work. It tells you how to door to door. How do you make door to door effective? How do you make a note, leave the right note on a piece of literature even when the person's not home? How do you follow up in that home? I mean, it's complicated doing grassroots right, but you can do it without money if you really know what you're doing.
I've read somewhere that one of the ways that you have this door-to-door a very effective strategy, but also this like statistical micro-targeting. And for you, that came from a great interest in sports.
Yeah, I think I'm one of the only Republicans who like lives and dies college basketball. It's really a weird mix. But I had some breakthroughs in how you value college basketball players. So everyone on New Mexico's basketball team has a value rating of how many points a game is worth to on. I have this value add basketball website, just a hobby. Just something. But Sports Illustrated and ESPN all have written me up on it. But some people think I'm crazy because they'd see me crunching precinct numbers for 16 hours, and they say, John, why don't you take a break? And I say, I've been on break for an hour. I've been crunching my basketball numbers. I'm still on spreadsheets. But so I do love that. There's a way to figure numbers out, and this is the problem most grassroots candidates have. They either love grassroots and some traditional working events, and they hate these young techies who have their numbers and all, or it's the opposite. It's all tech, it's all social media, they never talk to anyone. If you can marry those two, and that's what this book's for, you can beat big money, but you have to have both. You can't run the untargeted, I'm knocking on every door in this city, even though I don't know who the voters are or who votes. That just you're never going to win that way.
The name of your organization is Take Back Our Republic. We're talking about, as we've said, putting government back into the hands of citizens instead of big money. So tell me, when you go door to door, or when you talk to people in Alabama, what are they actually talking about? Like, what kind of problems in their lives are they trying to deal with that could be helped by better policy?
This is the beauty of door-to-door. I wish everyone. I mean, I've knocked on doors in 8 states in the last several years. I mean, just before even going into this. People's concerns are so similar. I mean, whether it's in upstate New York, I actually knocked on doors in Wyoming. Believe it or not, there's some places the doors are close enough in Wyoming. I mean, it doesn't matter where in the country. They're talking about their kids. They're talking about a school bus that goes down the road too quickly. And the problem is, in this hyper-polling environment, a lot of these elected officials, they don't see it because the consultants deciding which questions to ask and then telling you, well, this is the issue that works. Well, yeah, but that's out of the 10 questions you asked. There's so many things that bond people that are common that would be good for a candidate to just know. It's generally, it starts with their pets or their family or some hang up at job or some transportation, some road issue or something like that. The thing we'd always get people on Walmart's is, by the way, it's taking you 10 minutes to get to the interstate exit. It'll take you 45 minutes once there are 10,000 cars on this two-lane road. So just be ready for that. Those are the things you have to boil through to. And so the more you get candidates forced into talking to people, to their voters, you start to hear about these issues and not the fight that some billionaire in New York's having against a billionaire in Texas, both of which have picked one side of your race to give to. Yeah, so you got to bring those issues home. They're all local.
I think it's really important to talk about what participation in our political system means. And one of the problems is that there's so much cynicism about government itself. And frankly, a lot of that does come from the Republican Party, which since the Reagan era has explicitly said government is bad, we should have less of it, we should be suspicious of it. And yet we're if we're going to participate in our political system, we have to believe in it to some extent. We have to embrace it. We have to try to make it better. I mean, how do you reconcile that contradiction, which is in the conservative world?
Well, I think that you can want greater participation and smaller government at the same time. I don't think those are mutually exclusive. One chapter in the book, Taxation Only with Representation, that we published, it actually talks about the fact that if you look at government spending, it often tracks political contributing. So as you have spikes in political giving, you have spikes in government spending. And the argument is that's not because government suddenly decides they want to do a better job with education. It's because they have more and more donors that they're answerable to. And so you start overpaying for projects. You start building it up. So I think from a conservative perspective, these are completely consistent. I think getting higher participation in a lot of ways can be more people are paying attention to government. And is my money going toward a better school or a better road? Or is this being handed out as a favor? Is someone getting a sweet deal who's a political donor? So I understand what you're saying, but I think actually these two are not mutually exclusive at all. In fact, it can go either way. People not paying attention to government can also let there be runaway government in other areas. So I think there's an angle both for progressives and conservatives. They'll see the issue differently, but higher involvement will help no matter what your ideology.
So what brings you to New Mexico?
We really want to get a nice chapter going here. We've actually had a chapter that was based out in Redoso, and we'd had a good meeting there. And obviously want to spend a lot more time in Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and getting around. I do think the system here, when you look at the lack of enforcement for any of the campaign laws, is kind of one of the glaring problems in the country. Taken on a whole, it ranks high on the corruption list. I think a state like New Mexico, one, there's a corrupt system. In the way laws are not enforced and needing an improvement. You can improve quickly. Sometimes a small state, you can improve population-wise. You can improve a lot quicker than some of the dynamics of fixing California or New York or something. New Mexico's has also always been interesting. I actually drew a predictive map based on data back in 2000. I laughed because the only two states I missed were New Hampshire and New Mexico. I flipped them on who would go Gore and Bush, had everything else right. I think New Mexico is always so interesting because as the first state that was not majority, if you will, the diverse culture that you work with here, I think it's so interesting for testing so many just how does a democracy work. So we want New Mexico to be a very strong chapter for Take Back Our Republic. We've had a lot of people just sign up through the web and things, so there seems to be interest. So we're making the rounds and hope to build a strong chapter here.
And you're open to people of all parties?
We are. We say, you know, we are looking to educate people on conservative solutions for campaign finance reform. So we've had a good number of our chapters heads are pretty conservative background because we want conservatives to understand they're welcome. We usually find progressives understand very quickly they feel at home with the campaign finance group. So, but yes, we certainly have members from all over the political arena. In addition to contributors, we've seen great diversity in our membership.
John Pudner is founder and executive director of Take Back Our Republic. They're on the web at takeback.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the time.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.